Ah, a week. I come here to relax.
Have the healing power of poetry.
We've got a nice cup of tea.
So the first thing I'd like to do tonight, because there's certain interjections that happen in this course to support the rest of what we do, the kind of generic comments, is just to check in momentarily. Are you still listening actively to what we do and your own internal monologue? Are you still listening actively to that? Don't fall back into the teacher-student mode where you're listening, absorbing, interpreting, checking. Of course you're doing that, but make sure you're switched on. The batteries are fully charged up for the activeness, the activity of listening in and working out for yourself what this means for you and if it's familiar, if it's going to be useful or helpful, all that kind of stuff. And maybe even to bring to mind, now go off on a tangent and not listen to me for a few seconds if you feel it's productive, to just listen into your own sense of, would I use this for something? Have I done something like that before? What was that? What do I need to check later? So be in dialogue with the dialogue. Always be doing that in your own writing life, of course, but certainly when you're being taught, whatever that means, make sure that circuit is active. So I bigged this up last time, didn't I? I said it was a big way. Even bigger perhaps because of the amount to which it's underused. You might be different. Have any of you heard of third mind? Third mind. Well, don't worry, it's common in practically every workshop I've run on this way, way nine. One of the 16 ways of getting into poetry or producing something. It's hardly ever happened that anyone's even had a sense of what it might be, let alone known what it was. And I've always felt, and this is not to criticise you in any way or be condescending, although it probably is a bit. When I was at City and Guilds Art School, the equivalent would be I walked into a room and said, has anyone here ever heard of paint? No, paint, is that something? Don't they use that on walls somewhere in another part of the world? And they had no idea what paint was. You'd be amazed. You'd think it was a joke. And third mind feels like that to me. Because it's been so utterly productive and beautiful and prodigious as a way of writing that I've always given it its own space in my workshops on the 16 ways. It occupies a goodly section of the day or a whole evening or whatever that requires, because it's such an important way. We're missing so many riches by not knowing about it. So what I'm really hoping is that after tonight, you'll all be really well informed, not just by what I say and share, but by your own chasing up and looking into it. And you have to take it on trust to a certain extent to begin with. It's the Aladdin's cave that very few people know about on courses, but a lot of the very well-known poets do know about it. David Bowie knew about it in writing his song lyrics. Talking to many poets who told me they've done this or something like this, and they kind of keep it quiet. It's kind of a private thing, it seems. Because I've never heard anyone speak about it in a workshop. So that's why I bigged it up, because it's such an important way of writing. It's so underused. And I'm going to begin by reading you the definition from Wikipedia. Sorry about that. But it's quite good, rather than go to some kind of encyclopedic paper. So I'm reading this verbatim from an old Wikipedia page, The Third Mind. The third mind is a shared consciousness that can only be reached by two or more people together. They access a place that neither could reach alone. Person A and person B can find new ideas in dialogue because they are improvisationally responding to each other's unpredictable mind. So in other words, if you're having a conversation with somebody and you say, how did it go this week? You've got no idea what they're going to say back. Or even if you do, the way they're going to say it. So having somebody else interact with you is going to create surprises and juxtapositions you didn't expect. And the realm of that is this third mind that hovers above the two people or more people interacting and produces these surprises and insights. And it goes on to say, Burroughs, that was William Burroughs, was trying to access this unpredictability by cutting and rearranging texts into nonsensical riddles. I'll develop on that. It's not the only way you can do it. There's many other ways. By weaving the nonsense into a linear narrative, he forced himself into dialogue with an unpredictable other. Now, that's the crucial sentence. By weaving the nonsense into a linear narrative, through the cut-up, that is, he forced himself into dialogue with an unpredictable other. Now, if that's not a treasure that everyone's walking past, there's a £50 note on the street and nobody damn well picks it up, I don't know what is. And I think because it's long enough ago that people don't know about it directly, it didn't start in their lifetimes. It's also because it's not something that's given great value over here, more so in America and in Europe, not so much in the UK, I think. So it kind of began with the Dadaists. The Dadaists fell into, evolved into, were taken over by the Surrealists. And I love the Surrealists. They were a hugely discordant movement with fist fights and stuff. A bit like the old days at Earl's Court with the Poetry Society, where people would dissent and argue and get enraged about something that had happened in poetry, rather than all being so bloody polite. And there were manifestos, and there were people had fights over the manifestos. Poets don't do manifestos anymore. I kind of miss it. I think it'd be great to have a manifesto. You want something to kick against, as if we don't know where we are quite. We're kind of in Donald Davies' extended age of the confessionalist poet. Mm. You know, people individually writing about their own experience and maybe performing it, and that'd be performance poetry. But it doesn't seem to be a coherent sense of a group of people doing something in particular that they're loosely bound by, even with all the dissent and arguments. So you had the Dadaists, the Surrealists, in different ways. So Dadaism was a bit nihilistic and anti-establishment and came in response to the First World War. Ordered thinking produces things like world wars, so break it all up, fragment it, let something else come through. Don't trust the ordered mind. And Surrealism picked up a lot of that, but also enriched it and broadened it into the unconscious and Jung and dreams and Salvador Dali and so on. Yeah, this trust that language and meaning have inherent connections and patternings, and that there is a consciousness already there, kind of, in the language. Because language has had a huge investment made. It's kind of stored a lot of information, a lot of connections that we learn when we take up language. So even if you randomize language or semi-randomize it, there's a lot of information in there that's not always fully conscious. It's not contrived. It's accidental.
Can you just say that sentence again? Language and meaning have inherent...
Language and meaning have inherent connections and patternings. The consciousness is already there, even when things are thrown together at random, whatever that means. I've never quite believed in total randomness. I don't know quite. I'm thinking about that. But at random. So the Dadaists were in the 1920s or thereabouts, and you had this guy, Tristan Tzara. He's a real guy. He's not just a character in Stoppard's Travesties. He makes an appearance in the play. He was a Romanian, 1896 to 1963, and he got it all going, and he was pulling random words from a hat on stage, not always to the audience's pleasure. William Burroughs picked it up. He was a prose writer, and he used the cut-up predominantly to access his third mind, as he termed it. So it's about throwing things together randomizing text or semi-randomizing it so that the third mind can be more clearly apparent and more easily accessed and make itself better known.
So what context does cutting up text give you a third mind? It's not a dialogue.
It's not an exact definition, but the way I interpret it, it's just my definition or interpretation, is that you've got a text that somebody wrote.
Okay.
That's your first mind. Okay. And you've got the person coming in deciding a way to cut it up and how to rearrange it. There's your second mind. Then things start sparking and happening. There's your third mind.
Right, got you.
Something like that.
Got you.
Why do we bother doing it? And why does it lack currency? I think it's because it takes a certain courage to let go of your own effort in the initial stages of this, because anyone can do this. In the purest sense of cut-ups, you just cut them up and present what came out. This is what Sarah was doing on stage. This is what happens. It's aleatory. It's not my fault. It's not my good. It's just we're divorcing this from any control. That's the whole point, to get at something deeper, more ambivalent, more true, in a sense. Real, more authentic, okay. Less dangerous. I suppose on the superficial level, it's a way of avoiding cliche, and it's a way of breaking up old habits. And there's something Penelope Shuttle said, this is a quote, "The way chance often reveals deep preoccupations and concerns that get battened down by the conscious mind." The way chance often reveals deep preoccupations and concerns that get battened down by the conscious mind. So that opens something up. And there is a balance or a tension, depending on how you look at it, between sticking with what comes up exactly as it happened. That's the purest position, as I put it. Whatever happens, happens, that's it. That's the purest position. But you can move away from that to varying degrees and different ways and develop or edit or manipulate, maneuver, however you want to see it. And I call that the pragmatist position, the pragmatist. And you can choose both at different times, to different degrees. The purist just sticks with it exactly as it comes out. They don't change anything or minimally adjust anything.
Yeah.
Even if it's the of in and of the, they would pretty much stick with it. And the pragmatist gets involved and says, we can improve this. I want to do it. I don't want to do exactly what this has done. I want to manipulate, maneuver, change, shift, edit. So the cut-up, as one of the main methods, not the only method of accessing third mind, can give you fragments. It can give you an unexpected link or association or juxtaposition. Or it can just give you excitement. You might not quite know why you like or moved or stirred or irritated by what you found by doing the third mind. You might just get a feeling, a kind of sense. And sometimes I think that's the thing you can carry over, not the actual words, but that feeling, that energy, that dynamism, that freedom, that then becomes the mode from which you write or through which you write. So it's not always about what it produces, an artifact. It can be what happens in you when you do a cut-up that then spills over into the energy of the creativity and mood you're in when you write the poem itself, whatever that might be, if it's related to it or not. And I think, and this is through experience, so I can't guarantee it for you, but it certainly happened for me, that eventually you can just internalise the energy somehow. It just seems to bleed into you. So you don't have to do the cut-ups anymore. You just think that way. You just feel that way. You just kind of know where it goes most of the time. You've seen the patterns of what happens, and you can go there. That's beautiful. That is wonderful when that begins to happen. It doesn't always happen fully. No, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to write about my dad that way, as if it's already been done. And of course, you're not doing the cut-up, but you're kind of doing the cut-up, sort of. So I'm going to read you an example of something I got from using Third Mind, and this was from a book in Dublin. I was in my girlfriend's house, and her dad, who died, was a book lover, and he had Hilaire Belloc everywhere, just the ranks of it, and Chesterton, and he had this book there called the Routledge, or the, no, the Complete Letter Guide, the Complete Letter Guide by Routledge. So it was a template letter for every possible situation that a gentleman or a gentlewoman might find themselves in. So if you wanted to apologise for having said a harsh word, there was a format letter. If you wanted to break up with your fiancé, there was a letter. If you wanted to pay an overdue bill, there was a letter. It was fascinating, so I did a cut-up on that one. This is what came out, the Complete Letter Guide. I have just heard about your intended engagement to Mr. Bird. I must just write this line to congratulate you. I will just write this short note to say how deeply affected I was at the untimely death of your chihuahua. It is a very difficult thing for me to say anything to you about the loss you have sustained. I am convinced you will bear it like a man. I enclose the bill for the repair to my car caused by the collision. And that became one of my stock performance pieces. I read this so often at the beginning of a gig to get them laughing. I didn't always tell them it was a cut-up. So it sometimes lends itself to humour or horror or alarm or all kinds of... So Third Mind, so productive, so much fun, but can give you things that have that sense to them, especially if you select particular texts that might go that way. And the selection of which text you cut up is an important parameter. That's where you are kind of involved. You can choose newspaper articles, you can choose a book of poems by Seamus Heaney. That sets the tone. You're going to get qualities and flavours depending on what you select and why you select it. So that's where you set context of a kind, isn't it? You could do it completely at random somehow. I'm sure you can just open a dictionary at random and choose a word. You could do that. Apparently how the word Dadaism came into being. Somebody apparently opened a dictionary at random and that was a word they saw. I don't quite believe them, but that's the story. So we have the purist and the pragmatist. We have fragments, associations, whole poems that come out of it on occasion. The energy and the internalised sense of what cut-ups are that we just understand somehow by instinct, by intuition, and use when we're writing something. So you might do the cut-up to get the energy, not the cut-up. I'm not aware of anyone having said that anywhere. You do it to get the energy and then you write. Then you use the conscious mind, but with that being the conduit in a way. And if you were on the poetry science course, remember the title exercise we did? That is a very primitive form of cut-up. So you write a poem and you cut the title in. So I did that for you, but you could do it at random. And you got those remarkable effects where you'd written a poem about a light bulb and then you called it love or friendship or hate. And you got a completely different poem with the same words. That's I kind of got the idea to do that from cut-ups. I thought, what happens if it's just one word or one phrase, the title, that's all you touch. And you get these massive changes, these immense impacts. A poem that you read out, it's just a light bulb. Nobody cares, really. It doesn't mean much. And then you read it again with a new title, and it's suddenly a really terrific piece. It's got real potential. It might even get somewhere you'd never have got on your own, Third Mind. So the title exercise we did is a very primitive but very effective form of cut-up, as I see it. So the homework is to go and do a cut-up or two. Go and do a cut-up or two. Sift through all I shared with you about it. Choose where you want to be with that. But my suggestion would be do a purist one. Just do one. Purist. Just don't touch it. Just see what happens. See how you feel about that. Are you dissatisfied? Are you thinking, oh, come on, that's not going anywhere? I can see that that's happened, and nah, not for me. Or if you think, yeah, there's something, there's bits of it that seem to kind of mess around and not get anywhere, but I don't mind that somehow. Make up your own mind. Then do one much more consciously and decide what that means. Because you've got just cutting up words and phrases from a newspaper article or a magazine or a poem or a bit of a novel or several different novels or an academic article mixed in with something else. And see what happens. And see if you can feel the energy. That's really the ultimate goal. You probably won't if you've never done one before. Have you all done a cut-up before in some way? So, so you've done it, but you just don't know the context and theory. So go and maybe find out some of that. Read the Surrealist Manifesto in whatever incarnation you find it. There are so many of them, apparently. Or the Dadaists. Online, I think you can actually find some of the cut-ups Zara did. Look at some of William Burroughs' work. Do you like it? I really brought it hard into my teaching. Because I think it's such a productive mode. If you can get into it and use it consistently, it can give you stacks of stuff. I mean, it's really prodigious. So productive. And you might think, on the other hand, it's a bit lazy and you can get away with murder because it's art, inverted commas. Yes, there's always dangers to whatever methodology you use. So there's always dangers to any of these ways. But for me, this is one of the overlooked treasure troves of writing. That I keep meeting wonderful writers who don't know anything about it. I think you've done so much without this. You know, with your hands tied, with your legs tied together, with weights on your back, you've done so well. The book of mine that was really noticed, Chernobyl, Heavy Water book, a great deal of it has come through Third Mind. And it really shows, and it creates an eeriness and a strangeness and a power. Yeah, especially when you're starting out with these techniques, go through all of it, do it. Make yourself cut the pieces. It's almost as if you don't take any shortcuts at the beginning. You know, you respect the process. You get the scissors out and you cut up, you make a photocopy and then you cut up the words and you do it and you go, oh, why am I doing this? Well, yeah, you are doing it. A small caveat about choose where you want to be. Just initially, don't overwork, don't over-edit, because you're then reimposing all the stuff you tried to break away from by liberating the text.
Yeah.
There's a danger that you're so coerce it back into something that you lose that energy.
Yeah.
So that's just a warning. I'm not saying you can't do it. And when you get more confident in doing it, then maybe you will do something like that and it'll work. Just a warning to not do that too soon. Let the energies happen, let the freedom happen, and get really familiar with that joyous thing rather than clamping it down again. And the other thing was this idea of the cut-up as a priming activity. Actually do it. Do the whole thing. Take a page of text and cut up the text into individual words, including the A's, the the's, and the in's, and the prepositions. Actually do it, because that's an important priming to the priming. Because if you're going to use the energy of the exercise, you need to go through the whole of it. Invested somewhere in that process is part of the reason it works.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing the cut up as I wrote. I had a way of thinking and feeling and backing off an emergent text that felt like a cut-up.
But the text you start with has an energy itself. Like, did you ever have a
No, there was no initial text. I just wrote.
But when you did this.
Oh, when I did this with the text.
Yeah, with the text.
All kinds of ways. With the Routledge book, I just took lines and sentences. I sometimes cut newspaper articles, intercut them with scientific articles and something weird from Surfing USA or whatever.
Did you choose to bring very disparate things together?
I sometimes just let it happen.
Yeah.
Just went to see what was on the coffee table that day.
So would you start with like a meditation or breathing or anything just to sort of get your, clear your mind?
I found that the cut-up did that.
Okay.
That's why I said going through the whole process was part of, for me. It might be different for you, utterly different, but for me, I didn't have to find that was necessary. I just used the process to get to this place where I was no longer the protagonist entirely.
But they do know that using your hands does something to your brain.
Ted Hughes was very good on that. He said that this action of writing cursively was using a very different part of the brain from this action of using fingers to press buttons. I think he's right.
It's also the thing that if you use your non-dominant hand, you start accessing different parts. Mm. It's much more difficult to write with a non-dominant hand. It's really worth trying that too.
Okay.